Hi, Alexis Hale here, and welcome to podcast number 10. And I am recording this on Friday, the 7th of May, and it is the morning following Labour's disastrous showing in both the Hartlepool by-election and the local elections. So it seems to me now, as we unpick it, that Keir Starmer's plan to make the Labour Party more electable consists basically of losing a load of elections, elections that Jeremy Corbyn won, of course. One of the strategies that Labour employed to try and get some traction during this period was that they concentrated on what they called Tory sleaze, the corruption around the Conservative Party's acquisition of PPE and services during a pandemic. This completely failed to work. I mean, one of the reasons why it also left Labour vulnerable, I think, because one of Starmer's advisors was a guy called Peter Mandelson. Now, Peter Mandelson was a man who was forced to resign from the Labour front bench twice for dubious practices. And also bringing everything round, because everything's connected in this universe. Peter Mandelson, of course, was the former MP for Hartlepool. Now, I can't imagine he was a brilliant constituency MP. Somebody who lives in Hartlepool and listens to this may be able to contradict me, but I can't imagine really this power-obsessed, elite-obsessed, money-obsessed metropolitan was really a great representative for Hartlepool. And I wonder whether the people, when he was there, people in Hartlepool were saying, well, I don't mind my maternity ward closing as long as I can see my MP swanning around on a yacht off the coast of the south of France with an oligarch. Or I don't mind all the shipyards and the coal mines closing as long as my MP could be doing favours for foreign industrialists. So obviously, Starmer's strategy has been to completely marginalise the left, expel many members. And one of the things that that, of course, has done is that the only activists they had on the ground in Hartlepool, as I understand it, were paid activists, and they're all getting the sack today. Because Labour has also, according to what I read in The Guardian, run out of money. As somebody's quoted as saying, they don't have the small donors that Corbyn brought along, and none of the giant donors that Tony Blair had in his day can be asked contributing to the Labour Party. The only downside for me was I had a certain amount of faith in the Northern Independence Party. Now, the Northern Independence, I was talking to my friend Kerry-Anne Mendoza, the editor of the Canary left-wing news website the other week. And we were talking about a new theory in left circles is that you can't have a national party. What you need is lots of kind of local parties standing in various seats, socialist local parties, and they would form alliances on larger matters like defence or foreign policy and stuff like that. And I was hoping that the Northern Independence Party would make a better showing in the Hartlepool by-election. Because certainly Thelma Walker, I've only met on Zoom, but seemed like a very nice person. But they really only got, I think, about 250 votes. And I don't know what the lesson to be learned from that is. Possibly that although he is from the North, the founder of the Northern Independence Party, Philip Proudfoot, lives in Brighton. And Thelma herself is not local to the area. So I think that maybe if you're going to have hyper-local parties, and I still think it's something we're thinking about, then they really do need to be, everybody in it really needs to be from the neighbourhood. And I noticed, it's not getting much comments at the moment, but the person who came third was a woman journalist called Sam Lee, who does live in the area and has obviously got a high profile, former sports journalist. And she is clearly from the area, and that is a good thing. And Starmer, the people around Starmer as well. You know, I discussed on this program before how they are horrible people. They are horrible, horrible people. It turns out they're fucking incompetent as well. I mean, all they've got is fucking politics in their lives, and yet they can't fucking manage to even win some elections. You know, I mean, they're horrible, and they're stupid, and they're arrogant. Fucking arseholes. I mean, imposing that candidate, kind of rabidly remain a candidate on Hartlepool for a start. The arrogance of it is unfucking believable. And I'd just like to put in an advert for myself that everybody now is talking about what a shitbag Starmer is, but I've been doing this since November, I think. I was a very early adopter of the Starmer is a shitbag. But now you go out in the street and everybody's saying, and it also, I suppose the one problem with the right wing, the horrible right wing people, the one thing that they're good at is really weaseling their way into positions of power, because they've got nothing else in their lives, so they can spend all their time reading rule books and sitting in unbelievably boring meetings. So they kind of weasel themselves into positions of power. You know, it's a kind of type, isn't it? Like, you take Cressida Dick. Now, I don't think that Cressida Dick is the best police person in Britain, but of course, she seems really good at getting herself to be a senior police officer in the UK just by, you know, just kind of inserting herself into the power structures. And so it's a problem, really. It's hard to know how you dislodge these terrible, terrible, idiotic, stupid people around Starmer, how you dislodge them from those positions of power that they have weaseled themselves into. The thing about Starmer, I mean, he's coming across as such a kind of dick now that he also makes you think, well, what was he like as – it makes you reflect, really, on what was he like as director of public prosecutions, you know? I mean, I – wasn't particularly aware of him then, but you know, in retrospect, it's making me, what was his record as director of public prosecutions like? I mean, I'm starting to think that those men that he tried, those seven men that he had transported to Australia for stealing a loaf of bread, I think that might be a travesty of justice now. Starmer's a bastard. Just throw that out there. He's also like he's one of them people where the more you see him, the less you like him, really. John Crace, the Guardian's parliamentary sketch, I was basically in love with Keir Starmer, but even he wrote a piece. It was taken down or demoted quite quickly. But he said if Keir Starmer wants to win Hartlepool, he should stop going up there, because he's got that. He's got a horrible kind of – he should do some kind of Margaret Thatcher-style voice, because he's got a horrible, whiny little voice. And, of course, he also never says anything. I mean, he talks in these extraordinary empty phrases, completely vacuous policy light way of thinking. So that's my slogan. Keir Starmer's a bastard. If any of you listen to my stand-up or my sandwich bar, you will be familiar with, I sometimes talk about, I'll be to see my stand-up, in fact, you'll be familiar that I often talk about a Zen master who I consult, a Zen master who lives on Wuhan Mountain in Fujian province. And I recently had a Zoom call with the Zen master, and he gave me two pieces of advice. First of all, the Zen master said, if all the worms in the world disappeared, then within a year, the planet would be dead. If all the people in the world disappeared, then the planet would spring back to life. If Jack Whitehall disappeared, nobody'd give a fuck. I once shared a dressing room with somebody who'd been on tour supporting Jack Whitehall, and they said he was really nice. I think it's really important. You know, people say never meet your heroes, but I think it's more important to meet people that you slagged off, because you might find that they're lovely and you can't do it. I can't see it with Jack Whitehall, but you never know, I suppose. So the second piece of advice that the Zen master gave me was, he said, look down on no one, look up to no one, and don't steal sausages from the breakfast buffet at the Holiday Inn Express to have for your lunch, because your pockets will get all greasy. Now, it's an interesting idea. Obviously, people, and I'm relating this to people on the left, really, that I think, obviously, we don't look down on anybody, and that's a good thing about people on the left. Obviously, we you know, we are very concerned with those, with the oppressed. Been doing documentaries for Radio 4 about the Young Communist League and Communist Party. And I think one of the flaws of the left, and I've always thought this, is that we can be prone to hero worship, looking up to people, looking up with adulation of people. And I tried to think about why we are so prone to hero worship. I wonder whether on one level it is that just we feel so marginalized on the left. We feel so kind of beaten down, that our views are unacceptable, that we're racist, that when anybody does express left-wing views, we're like, oh, this is fantastic, I love them, oh my God, he said he liked the way, you know, he likes freedom, he said something good about Palestine. Ah! And one of the people on the left in Britain hero worship is Tony Benn. And for some reason, when lockdown started last year, I read all of Ben's diaries, which was interesting. And he is certainly, he's a man who was evolved, really. He moved from being quite centrist and being a minister, obviously, in Wilson's government, to a much more left-wing position. And he was very good on the Middle East. He was good on social oppression. He was a very articulate speaker. He could articulate a left-wing vision. But on the other hand, he smoked a fucking pipe. I'm sorry, but somebody is smoking a pipe, right, it's like going around with a piece of plumbing in your gob, isn't it? A piece of plumbing that's on fire. So Tony Benn, good and bad in some ways. And we're also talking, weren't we, on the podcast about left-wing people having bastard right-wing children. And certainly Tony Benn's son, Hillary, is a pompous right-wing shit. And apparently there's a daughter, I think, Emily, who is also of that same cast. And I wonder, and one of the things that I kind of made me ambiguous about Benn was that politics for his family was dynastic. I think Benn's great-grandfather would have been a politician. His father was a politician. Benn was, his son is a politician. His son's daughter is a politician. And there's something, there's something like I find unsettling about that. So really, there are no, let's be more critical about people, even if they are left-wing. Let's be more critical about people on the left, because there are no heroes on the left, apart from me. And Jeremy Corbyn.
Rah, rah, rah. We got an email in about Hillary, Benn, actually.
Go on.
To add to pretty much what you covered it, but like just to add to that list of left-wingers with right-wing kids.
It's a funny. And interestingly enough, this documentary I've been making for Radio 4 about the Young Communist League, everybody in it who I interviewed, they were all... Their parents were also in the Communist Party, and even their grandparents, one of them, their grandfather had actually been killed fighting against fascism in Spain. So it's funny, really, that certainly, and I've talked to quite a few, that the kids went along with what the parents believed completely, really, and had a great deal of love and affection for their parents, but also entirely bought into their parents' communist belief, which was kind of surprising, really. But
Which didn't happen to you, or?
Yeah, it did, yeah. Well, kind of. I mean, I actually moved further left than my parents, and then I also, I became very ambiguous about the Communist Party in later years. So that's the topical, political part of the show, always on it, always commenting on events as they happen. I would also like to talk about, now we've finally decided to go all in on this sponsorship thing, and we Patreon, is it called?
Yeah, Patreon.
Patreon.
Yeah.
Patreon. Now you've mapped out a web page and all that, a page for giving on Patreon, and you had all this, you wrote all this upbeat stuff and like give £2 and you're a mate, and give £5 and you're a superstar. And in response, I wrote this, which Linda thought was stupid, but you actually quite like it. So this is my proposal to get people to subscribe to my Patreon page. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant believed that there was a supreme principle of morality, which he referred to as the categorical imperative. Kant argued that the only moral act was one that was performed out of a sense of duty. In other words, if you derive any pleasure from your actions or any material benefits, then those actions cannot have any moral worth. Therefore, I am asking you to support my digital content. I don't want to accept advertising, but Talal, Audio Boom, having great guests, being able to record remotely, getting the podcast mixed and engineered, all costs money. If you chip in, all this can continue. Though I say in brackets, it'll probably continue anyway. However, this is a promise. If we get in more than our costs, I promise I'll donate the excess to some doomed extreme far-left cause. To aid fundraising, I've created three categories of giving. Silver membership, this costs £2 a month. If you give £2 a month, you will get absolutely nothing. Then next we have executive gold membership, which is £5 a month. If you become one of our executive gold members, this will entitle you to absolutely nothing at all. Super Platinum Gold membership, and this is £10 a month. If you join the Super Platinum Gold membership scheme, you will not gain entry to special lounges at airports and railway stations, and you won't get a special gift every month either. So that's my pitch, really, to raise money. And you were...
So I was trying to, essentially say the same thing, but in a nice way and evoke some sort of emotional connection and commitment.
Well, you said Patreon themselves have a kind of subdivision where they'll put your fucking photo on a mug or something.
Yeah. You can get these, like bog standard merch from Patreon, and then they take a bigger cut. And it's very typical of podcasts with Patreon pages to offer little perks for their patrons.
Patrons.
Well, just things like, bonus podcasts or like little snippets and videos and merches and buttons and stickers.
I do believe in the Kantian moral imperative, and we can talk about this not on this show, but I think we can talk about it later. But I do have a funny story about Kant, which was when Linda studied philosophy at Birkbeck. I think this story was told to her by one of the professors there, and he said there was a moral philosopher, a Kantian. He was in New York, and he was going down into the subway, and he's supposed to like walk on the right in the subway. For some reason, he walked on the left, and a transit cop stopped him. Now, I should point out this, that if you say Kant in the correct Germanic way, rather than saying Kant, you pronounce it with a softer kind of, so it sounds more like cunt, basically. Anyway, the cop, the transit cop stopped the philosophy professor and said, you walk down the wrong side of the stairways. And the philosophy professor said, I wanted to get to the train quicker. And the transit cop said, well, what if everybody did that? And the philosophy professor said, ah, yes, cunt. So the cop sat on his neck for 9 minutes.
Oh, no.
So anyway, there's a funny story about, how Kant can get you into trouble, really. But so I don't know what you think about doing that appeal or, going with your, you're a mate.
I don't think it matters. I really like what you did. I thought it was very funny. But in the end of the day, please contribute. We really appreciate it. If you can spare the money, it goes a long way, man. Because all this, as many of you have noted in the emails and the YouTube comments, this is all coming out of Alexi's pocket. It's awful, isn't it? Some of the struggles you do. So that's his Kantian commitment to you.
Yeah.
Dedicating his money and time to provide this wonderful material for you all, but it would be great.
You got to do the page and put my blurb up.
I will replace my Teletubby text for your wonderful.
Has it gone live yet? You haven't put it up yet.
Technically, it is live, but I haven't put it anywhere, so no one has seen it. But I will start. Well, now we're talking about it.
Yeah.
So if you want to help keep the show going, pay for me and our engineer Anthony who does a great job, Anthony Ovelton, and to pay our Zencaster fees, our Audio Boom fees, and to prevent this show from ever having, you know, a flash advert or, yeah, you know, selling mattresses or underwear to you guys. If you want to prevent, that's basically the motivation for you guys. If you don't want the middle of this podcast to start having adverts in it, which would be the inevitable end result if we don't start finding a way to monetize the show, please head over to our Patreon. There are all such wonderful perks you can gain, such as nothing, absolutely fuck all, and go fuck yourself. That's at patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast. And if you don't know how to spell Alexi by now, like a lot of our listeners do, then we're fucked. No,
please. Yeah, I mean, even go fuck yourself is going a bit far, because that's kind of giving something, isn't it, really?
That's
absolutely
true.
Absolutely.
Some people pay good money for that experience. Before we move on to emails, Alexi, have you heard the Lego news?
You sent me a... Yeah, go on.
It's not really news. It's nothing official. But one of our listeners has basically immortalized yourself in the medium of Lego. They've made a little Lego Alexi. I sent you a picture of it. And that was Make It Jones on Instagram.
Is there a way that people can see that?
Yeah, just go to our Instagram account, Alexi Sale Pod. I'm reposting it, but please go and show Make It Jones some love. We'll tag him in the post. But he's done a little, Lego version of you wearing all black, kind of in your the Godfather. I mean,
it's not me now, is it?
I really think it might be. It's the more recent.
Who is it? I think it's sort of tied to Alexi, isn't it? The sort of 80s, 90s Alexi.
Well, no, you're not wearing your suit. And your beard is grey. You've got big, bushy eyebrows. So I think it's more a more modern...
I've misunderstood. Yeah.
From your comeback tour or something.
Yeah.
But he called it the Godfather of Alternative Comedy Lego, but he's hoping to make more. He's going to make some from your different eras, basically, and represent you in all different
forms. That is a noble enterprise.
But what spurred him to do this was, I don't know if you're aware, but various movie franchises, such as like Avengers or Star Wars or Jurassic Park, Lego make these computer games for it, where you play little Lego versions of the film characters and you play through the story of the films. Now, they did a Lego Indiana Jones series of games.
All right.
And your character in Indiana Jones was a playable character in the game. Did you do any voice work for that or anything?
No.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
But he was gutted to see that your character wasn't released as an actual official figurine kind of thing.
So yeah.
He's now going to start making them.
Okay, well, good.
But I am going to get that game and play it and see. I want to see if they've got maybe some sound alike or if they're using clips from the film to voice you, your character.
Yeah. I think my deal was a buyout, so I wouldn't get any back end.
I've
never had any royalties from anything having to do with Indiana Jones. So I don't really care, but good to know.
You're kidding. Really. Well, then I'll nick the game.
No, but you don't. You see, I mean, I was going to talk about cognitive dissonance, Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance. I've just remembered. I think we'll talk about it next time. But I think talking about the Kantian categorical imperative is enough for that for this week. But next week we'll talk about Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance. But two things. There was a video game that came out. I think it was a British one, but it was set where you stole cars and drove around London and in central London. Because I live in, and one of the cars that you could steal was the car I was driving then, which was an Alpha 166. And it went, and also the game went down my street. So I bought that game, and all I did with it was get an Alpha 166 and sit outside my house.
recreating reality. It was a simulation.
Yeah, I just used to sit in this 166.
Was that The Getaway?
I don't know what it was. It was a British one. It was you went round the streets of Central London.
I believe, yeah, that was The Getaway. And I was like a pre-teen or just a young teen when that came out, where they like beautifully recreated London using photographs of all the buildings. And they were very tried to make it very realistic. And I remember getting that game and then getting so excited and hyped and trying to drive to my house. I'm in the outskirts of London. I'm in Ealing. And I was so optimistic that they'd done all of London.
What happens when you drive off the edge?
I was just bumping into the edge constantly trying to get home. And my brother was just laughing at me, calling me an idiot.
I didn't do anything more with the game than I just got in an Alpha 166. Drove to my house and just sat there outside.
Well, so you're not keen to give the Lego Indiana Jones a go?
Well, no, it's nice. I mean, I don't mind. I mean, it's a really good. I think it's the Indiana Jones 3, which it is in many ways the best of the Indiana Jones movies. I think my part doesn't add a tremendous amount to it, but it's a really good. It's a really good film. So, I'm very grateful to be associated with it, even in a small way. And the fact that I'm not getting any back end from all this merch is it makes me bitter. It makes me sad. The reason I understand it was that British actors, and one of the reasons that British actors were used, it may have changed now, but the British actors in American movies were never entitled to royalties, but the United States actors were, after the Screen Actors Guild negotiated royalties, and the president of the Screen Actors Guild who negotiated that royalty deal was Ronald Reagan.
Well, of course it was, yes.
Yeah, so if you, obviously he was pretty bad, but if you're an American actor, then you can thank Ronald Reagan for getting you royalties on...
You can argue he probably did it for selfish reasons so that he could get royalties on his own film.
It's, terrible people could do good things.
And does that mean the Americans' trade union system is much more effective than ours, perhaps?
Certainly in terms of Screen Actors Guild and Screenwriters Guild,
Well, I was hoping this would result in me and you playing Lego Indiana Jones together, but I guess that's not going to happen.
I don't know. We'll see. I'll tell you what, though. The Lego movie is also surprisingly good, isn't it?
It is,
one.
Really
it's
funny.
It's very moving. I mean, that's, again, the brilliance of Hollywood screenwriters, that you think, well, fucking hell, this is just a vacuous piece of merchandising. But it is actually quite they turn the tables, and it's quite a moving story about childhood and loss, isn't it?
Surprisingly so. And very, authentically made. It's all completely stop motion, very little computer effects and stuff. Yeah, that's a great one. Okay, maybe we could recreate a moment from the set when you were on set. Have your character walk up to Indy and then he get him to say, "You're quite funny, aren't you?" And then you say, "I am." You know, that famous story from the set of Indy.
That was Sting. No, Harrison Ford. No, Sting said to me, "You're really funny, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." Harrison Ford said to me, he said, "I'm a really big fan of yours." He said, "That's what he said to me." And I thought, what fucking use is that to me?
That's right.
Was my first thought, really.
That's
Buy me a house. But I did. I talk about on the bike ride to just cross-pollinate there. I talk about wanting to be best friends with Matt Damon. I thought for a second that I could be best friends with Harrison Ford, really, but there wasn't an awful lot of chemistry between us. I mean, he's a funny guy, but I didn't feel like we were going to be mates.
He's quite a subdued guy, isn't he?
He was hilarious at lunch. We had lunch with him, and he told some hilarious stories about Princess Margaret. I remember. And maybe at some point, I have told the story before on Chat Shows, but I'll tell the story about me and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and the gravy on my groin.
Oh, yes. Let's tease that
yeah,
up.
Yeah, okay. Next time.
Yes.
So, yeah, let's talk to next time.
And yeah, growing gravy.
The story of Alexei Sayle, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and the gravy on my groin.
All right, I have an email for you, Alexei, before we go. This is from Jem. Did you ever meet a Beatle? Or do you remember growing up in Liverpool during Beatlemania?
Yeah, the only Beatle that I met was... This is another show-busy story in a way. The only Beatle that I met was... But it's also a very... Is this too self-regarding to say it's quite an Alexei thing? For some reason, Dave Gilmour... of, you know, Pink Floyd and so on and so forth, invited me to his wedding, or his wedding party anyway. The band at the wedding party, which was in the town hall in Fulham, I think, were the bootleg Beatles. But also a guest at the party was George Harrison.
No.
So George Harrison was standing there looking at a kind of version of himself performing. At that point, Linda... decided to talk to him, but she was a bit overexcited. She started babbling at him about jazz, I seem to remember. And you can just see him look. And he was like an old, you know, he was in many ways, George Harrison was born in, what, the 40s or something? He was an old, you know, he's an old muso in many ways. And I just remember Linda's babbling to him about jazz. And you can just see him sort of thinking, why is this bird talking to me about jazz? And I think he walked off. That's the only time, I think I said, like, the only time I've actually met a Beatle. I've never met Paul or Ringo, obviously not. John. I was a bit, Linda used to go to the Cavern and saw them because she's a couple of years older than me, but I was too young, really, slightly too young to be part of that. The sort of big thing for me, I think, in Liverpool was the kind of Mersey Poets thing, which came slightly after, you know.
Mersey Poets?
Yeah, Adrian Henry, Roger McGough, Brian Patton.
Uh-huh.
It was a big thing in Liverpool. And that was sort of more my... I've mentioned it in my first volume of memoir. I think that the Beatles were playing the Liverpool Empire, but instead my parents took me to see the Red Army Ensemble, which was a group of KGB torturers who sang, you know, Roll Out the Barrel and stuff like that. I never saw them or anything. And I think I'm vaguely related to their manager, Brian Epstein. I think I am vaguely related to Brian Epstein. That's pretty poor. Well, it's not a bad, the showbiz anecdote, but Dave Gilmour's wedding. I do feel a bit sorry for George Harrison sort of staring at a kind of a tribute band of himself, really.
Yeah, that's so surreal.
It was surreal, really, yeah.
Why would Gilmour hire them?
I know, that was odd, wasn't it? I'm sure, I don't think I've made any of this up. I don't know why he had...
Just hire like a nice wedding band that might throw in a Beatles cover here or there. But if you're inviting a Beatle to your wedding and then you pay a Beatles cover band to play, surely that's some sort of message he's trying to deliver to George Harrison.
Yeah,
like a power move, like Pink Floyd. We're so powerful.
Yeah, I don't know. Dave Gilmour's not really like that, is he?
Oh, okay. He wasn't an insidious, plotting, scheming.
No, he's a very good man.
Oh, okay. All right, then. Well, then that probably wasn't the case. Well, there you go, Jem. Hope that answered your question. He has met a Beatle.
Yeah. I keep saying we're talking about this, but I also spent 3 days in John Lennon's house when I was doing a radio program, and you know, which has been bought by English Heritage, I think, or the National Trust, or somebody in John Lennon's house on Menlove Avenue. And I will talk about. And I've also spent time in Paul McCartney's house in also in Liverpool, which is also a you know a, site of special scientific interest now. And I could talk about that probably not today. All these teasers! But I'll talk about that later date, yeah.
Maybe when we take the bike ride up to Liverpool.
That's a fucking brilliant idea. Yeah, it's a really good idea. Let's do that, yeah. We'll go up to Liverpool and we'll ride to Menlo Avenue and we'll go to John Lennon's house and we'll go to Paul's house as well. Interestingly enough, I don't know whether it's the guy had actually lived in John Lennon's house. The guy, the bloke who gave you the guide, so he lived in like a secret, and he had like a microwave and that hidden behind a panel. Because he had to live as if it was the 1950s. And he fell in, it was a woman who lived in Paul McCartney's house in similar circumstances. Anyway, they met and fell in love and got married. That's a nice story, isn't it? Yeah.
Her and Paul. Oh, no, the two guides.
The woman guide who lived in Paul McCartney's house. Married the guy who lived in John Lennon's house, yeah.
That's cool. Oh, but let's not forget to go to your old house and your old haunts as well. Let's not just make it a Beatles tour of Liverpool. Superb.
Well, we could maybe do that quite soon, really.
Oh, I would love to. Yeah. I think we should technically be allowed to at any point from now onwards.
Yeah.
So I'm on it, mate. I'm up for it.
All right. Let's do it next.
Okay, cool. Look, we'll do a more email heavy episode soon, but just want to say thank you for all the lovely emails and friendship applications. I go through and read them all and I save up the best ones and we'll read them out on air soon. But I think we're going to wrap up here. But just say we've had a lot of really nice messages and a lot of people are saying they love the new stream of consciousness style. You've really settled into this format, Alexi, and we're getting a lot of love for the show. So I just thought I'd let you know that before we ended. So thanks for that, guys. All right, you ready to wrap this up, Alexi?
Am I doing that? Yes. Thank you, everybody. Bye. This has been the Alexis Hale podcast, produced and edited by Talal Karkouti, sound mixing by Anthony Overton, hosted by Audio Boom. And please give our Patreon page a visit, patreon.com/AlexisHalePodcast. Thank you so much. Bye.